Howdy, I'm Paul Isaac Yoder, and this is Author's Dozen, a podcast where I explore barriers to storytelling by writing one novel every month for 12 months. Please enjoy.
All right, welcome to the Author's Dozen podcast. Here we are. Just a look behind the curtain. I'm on Zoom right now with my latest guest, and we've been talking for about 15 minutes, and suddenly I have to turn on this voice that is totally unnatural to me. And that's the way that it goes. Speaking of guests, guest, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Dylan Terry. I am a writer based out of Boulder, Colorado. I do some podcasting. I do some game, like tabletop writing. And I think Paul is one of my oldest friends, I think. We went back to like kindergarten, if not that.
Yeah.
Tiny grade school. We were two of the only writerly people who shared work with each other. Yeah, it's nice to reconnect over something that we've both kind of fallen into mutually independently.
Yes, I was thinking back about the early writing times, and my first book was, or the first sort of like thing I was trying to make, number one, it was like a straight ripoff of third book in the Timothy Zahn Thrawn trilogy. I was just gonna like reskin that as like a pirate, you know, on the seven seas sort of thing. And then I had this other one where it was like these three cool dudes, and they like went around on a spaceship, and one of the gimmicks was that like you had these like sunglasses that you could put on, and you could see like where bullets were gonna go or something. Yeah. And I ended up using that in one of my later books. So
nice.
Here we go.
Oh yeah, you gotta recycle ideas when you have them early.
I remember you were very invested in trying to make our middle school siege proof. You were very against ramparts. You were like, no,
it was it was an indefensible building. And I stand by that, having finally gone back this last October to look at it.
Yes, you did lay siege to the building.
Yes, no one was in it.
I remember.
But
yes.
Yeah, there we are.
our journey was, through those years. And then into high school, we actually had some really great English and, you know, literature sort of teachers who they actually started a little bit of a writing class. And it was a very encouraging thing, because you know, when you're in a very small public school in the Midwest, you don't always get that, and you don't always get the sort of like specialized attention.
Athletics. We were very fortunate, and I lay a lot of this ongoing momentum at the feet of various English teachers from, I say, some of the middle school ones too, even back to elementary school. Our English staff was very encouraging of the kids who decided to put words onto paper, no matter how derivative they may have been.
And my first crack at playwriting, we actually collaborated on some stuff there.
I remember. So. Oh yeah, it got performed.
Yeah, and the fact that you could write something and it could get performed.
There's one joke I keep making from that play where it's I think someone had asked, the landlord is like, I have kids to feed. Someone asks, you have kids? He goes, I don't know, probably. There's just something about that joke just struck a chord in me, and I remember that to this day.
It was groundbreaking for sure.
Oh yeah.
So regardless, we're talking about modern works now. The modern Dylan Terry and Paul Yoder phase. The last book I read from you, I'm curious to hear where that's been going. So it's a fantasy, sort of like a Mad Max kind of.
It's kind of a Western, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was only referencing Mad Max for like the, it's like a gift from point A to point B, and, try not to die sort of thing.
Yeah. I sent it out to a few different people and got, some form letters back that they weren't interested, which is fine. That's just how it goes. I've been kind of sitting on that one for a little bit, just kind of seeing if I can go back to it. I've put down about 15,000 words into a follow-up. It's not a direct sequel, but some of the characters come back.
Yeah.
But a lot of my creative pursuits have been kind of hijacked by paying work and some podcasting endeavors.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. That's, you know, that's the trick, right? Is that behind the curtain again, the writing process often ends up with the writer trying to hook an agent with a you know, series of convoluted tasks that include like query letters and, you know, page submissions and all these sorts of things. And I really enjoyed your book. And so, you know, there's a part of this process where you could get 100 no's and get one yes. And the yes, you know, is what
that's all that matters.
Exactly. Yeah. And so there's, you know, any number of reasons, especially that just you can't like take a rejection and be like, oh, my work is just not good. You know, it's there are 99 reasons to, you know, say that, hey, this isn't what I want to be representing. And only, you know, 99 to one, it's something that isn't like the quality or of your writing. It's like the subject matter or the, you know, the tone, the, yeah.
The attitude of whoever served them breakfast that day.
There's also just like, hey, I have someone else on my roster who already does this. I don't need to compete with that.
Mm-hmm.
You never know what it is. And so that's the trouble, right? Is, you send it into this, black box and out pops, you know.
Sometimes nothing.
Exactly. Yeah.
Sometimes nothing, but sometimes just what you need. Yeah.
Yeah. So we will, I will keep an eager eye on that. And yeah, we will continue on. But
oh, yeah. That's all we can do.
Right. Indeed. So, on that note, you also read something from me. Could you give could you give maybe like a paragraph or two on like what the story you read was about?
So Ironclad Nocturne is a genre mashup of various science fiction fantasy elements set in the massive, seemingly constructed world machine. Tora, an armor pilot of some sort, has to struggle with the fact that her childhood friend seems to have fallen in with a revolutionary gang. And as she contends with that fact and her friend, the secrets of the world might be exposed, .. No, Ironclad Nocturne is a very fun, kind of strange science fantasy. People in mech suit, not mech suits, people in power armor fighting each other in a world that seems to have been either artificially constructed or massively built upon.
So the way I pitch this to people, that's a great rundown. The way I pitch this to people, it's sort of a like a revenge Western, where instead of going like out into the wilderness, you're going down into the wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea, like you said, there's a lot that is unknown about the world that they're inhabiting. And so that's part of the fun of like getting to uncover that. However, the end of the book that I gave to you is not the end of the story. Far from it, because and so I did just the world was it was huge and had all these mysteries and sorts of things, and so I didn't really want to tie the knot on that in just 50,000 words. So, yeah. So that being said, how would you judge this as like a book in and of itself?
I think there's a lot of good stuff here, but it very much reads as the first act of a story all the way through. I got to about maybe 75% of the way through, maybe even 2/3. And I started to have this thought where I'm like, this isn't going to wrap things up.
Right.
Or if it does, it's going to do so in a very, very quick and non-satisfactory manner.
Right.
Now it ends with, and I'm assuming I've listened to a few episodes, you don't care about spoilers because these are prototypes.
Yeah.
It ends with the gang getting together.
Mm-hmm.
It ends with the last two members of the gang getting together and Tora, the narrative character, deciding that she is going to live or die, take this fight to its conclusion.
Right.
Which is a fine ending. I want to preface this by saying that writing any endeavor such as this, such as writing novels over the course of a single month, and writing a novel such as this, which is really dense with what the reader needs to see in the setting for it to make sense, is an impressive endeavor. And I don't mean anything that I say here to come across as super derogatory towards that.
Yeah, but we're here for the critics, you know? That's what it's about. Yeah.
I thought, I'm not quite sure where to start on this. there's a lot I want to talk about, because there was an itch to this novel that, or there was a scratch to this novel that hit an itch I didn't really know I had had. It was about the point where Tora and who's the ascetic consort she meets with?
Yeah, that's Gabriel.
The first one, the member of her gang,
right?
Junhan? No. it's after she blinds Rosie. The first ironclad fight in the alleyway. When the suits start showing up and they start getting into them and fighting, then I'm like, okay, this is really cool.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you start getting into some of the aspects of the armor, and they have different classes and stuff. And I'm thinking, okay, as I was formulating what I was going to say to you, I was trying to stay away from this phrase because in my mind as a genre writer, it's kind of a cop-out criticism that the world feels fully realized. Mm-hmm. Which I think is somewhat of a cop-out note, because it seems like if you're going to write genre, the first thing that should happen is the world become fully realized.
Right, yeah.
It's something I receive a lot when I write genre work. It's like, wow, your world feels really lived in. And I'm like, okay.
Yes, but that was a given. It's like, yeah, that's definitely...
yes. However, I think it does need to be mentioned that you have a world that is, as far as I can tell, not Earth. Or if it is Earth, it is so far in the future it is unrecognizable. So regardless, I never, when it was addressing elements of the setting, it always felt like that was coming across as very authentic. Mm-hmm. I wanted more of what the world was like. We get, because I think the opening scene with Tora speaking to the guy on the train to get Rosie's information to contact her. Mm-hmm. That felt very cool because they're on like a subway. They're having a covert meeting. Everybody has these, they call them brights, which are semi-integrated personal displays that float near your head and you can turn them to public or private or something like that. Mm-hmm. They're doing this kind of subversive gangland style interaction. I'm like, this is really cool. I guess I'm just going to go kind of through the storyline that I remember and just say what I liked and how I thought of it. They go to a pleasure house. I don't quite know how to phrase it elsewise.
Yeah, more of a,
a house for people to have private rooms. And she meets up with Rosie, who in the prologue, you see Tora and Rosie kind of escape a coup attempt. Because it turns out Rosie is an heir to the title of Marchioness, or Marchon. I don't know what the male version of that would be. Doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's the written
word. It doesn't matter in the story.
Exactly.
Right. We find out Rosie's fallen in with a gang of folks called the Eclipse, who are a little bit of Eyes Wide Shut animal maskers. they're all very, vague and hiding in the shadows and obtuse in their wording. And then you'll learn that Rosie has gone full radical and has joined up with them to strike back. Tora realizes this would draw unwanted attention, blinds her, they flee, there's a fight. There's a long portion of the novel which follows in which they go home and they kind of just relax a little bit. And then they realize that people are after them. So they go to a factory. They go to their hidden armory, which is hidden in the machine lair, which is another very cool concept. there's some interpersonal tension that shows up. There's some reconciliation with their leader, Jun.
Yeah.
I believe Jun is the leader of their little orphan gang, because they're all orphan gangs and a member of the Ironclad squad. They all have individual roles. They get attacked by Eclipse, the gang. They fight. Eclipse reveals that they have infernal or otherwise otherworldly powers. Tora gets thrown into the pit you know, metaphorically, she falls. She encounters someone who is able to speak to the reader in a second person tense, who doesn't really show up again in this first act of the novel, every once in a while. And then Tora spends the final third or quarter of the novel gathering a group together to strike back at the people who hurt her. And that's when the novel ends.
Yeah.
Just to give a rundown.
Right. Yeah.
Now, your notes when you handed me this said to read it as a reader, so I did have to kind of read this sporadically when I could, either on lunch break at work or if I'm waiting, if I'm in a coffee shop or something. I didn't take notes, but you can see what stuck with me.
Yeah.
A lot of the more striking setting imagery stuck with me. The story beats stuck with me because, admittedly, this is a story that I, it's a story that I've seen a few times. And it's not a bad thing.
No.
At all. I like a good gangland revenge story. A good Western where your posse gets killed and you go after the person who did it.
Yeah.
Great. I've written my own. Everybody does. It's good stuff. We were talking about Scott Lynch earlier, and I saw very, very strong echoes of the first book, Lies of Lacamora, in some of these events happening. Which, that's not a revolutionary book, really, but, you know, we all go to some wells occasionally.
Yeah, yeah. When it comes to, like, going off of that, like, well-trod path of revenge and these sorts of things, what stood out to you as, like, the same or different?
What stuck out most to me was Tora and Rosie's relationship and falling out. Because you start the novel with a prequel of them as children, very young children, while their home is being attacked by armored figures intent on killing them. Or at least that seems to be their thoughts. And then almost immediately they have a massive falling out, which results in some acts of horrific violence on both of their sides against the other. You have Tora stabbing Rosie's eyes out, and you have Rosie's demon-assisted crew really just walking all over these people in a way that is, I'm no stranger to acts of gruesome and sudden violence in works of fiction, and the attack by White Eyes on the Jun clan took me aback a bit, and it was effective. I enjoyed it, but to have some of the imagery in that, the leg being crushed, the sounds of the armor filling up, I'm just like, oh man, I thought that was very effective. But I think in particular, it is the fact that you took, I think a lot of writers would take the easy route of having the childhood friends in a prequel kind of go this way and then back in. But to have Rosie so fully compromised by power against Tora, and to have Tora kind of push back as well, I think that's kind of what stuck out primarily. It's like, these two do not have the same relationship they had when they were children.
Right.
Very much so.
This last couple of months, I've been going through the Red Rising series, which is just like, it's sort of a revenge, sort of like a revolution thing, but
I'm not familiar,
but yeah, it's a science fiction thing. And, you know, telling a story from like a close third person, you can start to get a little bit like navel-gazy, where your protagonist, is just like, you're constantly like hearing about their emotional like turmoil and like, oh, woe is me. And, these sorts of things. Did I get carried away like that, or was it, was it less like Tora centric, I suppose?
Tora never struck me as being too self-addressing. She never struck me as like, you said navel gazing. I never really got that impression while I was reading it.
Okay.
There are definitely points where the characters wax philosophic, and Tora definitely does that.
Yeah.
But it never struck me as too much, and I never kind of rolled my eyes at her inner dialogue.
So on that note, what if you had to pick something that like was a little too much or too little?
There's a lot of traveling. There's a lot of characters running through machine lair. There's a lot of characters going places, having a single conversation and going somewhere else. Which the imagery, at least that first time that I think it's, man, I can't remember his name. Tora and the guy she meets with at the pleasure house are like running back to the strawberry fields. I was like, okay, this is cool. They're like running on rails and they're hopping over vents and stuff. And you see the world machine kind of rearranging itself magically, you know, but, and I hesitate to say magic because this could be like Larry Niven style technology where it's indistinguishable.
Yes, exactly.
And I really liked that. And then it happened again. And then it happened again. And then there was another one. And I'm like, okay, this is fine. It started to feel a little bloated on the focus of, I don't want to say mundane, because from our point of view as the reader, it would not come across as mundane.
Right, but once it happens four or five times.
Yeah, you start to, you know, there are more efficient uses of text than to have them do an Aaron Sorkin style run on the wall and discuss things scene.
The offender I was thinking of while you were describing that was like the Star Wars prequels, just like a slow walk and talk, just like, oh, you know, the whole movie is like conversations of like people slowly walking through halls,
as walking like, down a hallway, one person stops, one person goes to the window, they reverse. This novel's a lot more kinetic. There's a lot of movement. And I think using the suits was a really good tool to make the characters feel like they had a lot of motion in the narrative. I suspect a lot of this comes down to, I had initially entered this thinking it was going to be a little more self-contained, and getting to the end and what I would have expected to happen about 120 pages in, as opposed to at the end of a 230 page novel.
Right.
Which clearly I'm not averse to reading multiple entry novels.
Like, right.
That's not a problem. I think it just caught me off guard once I got closer to the end. And I think that's more a statement on my process of going into this project that you had asked me for than anything about the novel itself. If I had known it was a part one, I would have been far less caught off guard by it.
Sure.
I also think, despite the fact that it's a part one, there could have been a more explosive ending.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be big and spectacle, but instead of, like, they go to this weird demon, it's like a wasp nest built out of metal and carved with math runes, and I'm like, that's cool. That imagery is very cool.
Yeah.
There are two weird people inside it who are like demon hubs of some sort. And I think you use the word demon.
Shaman is
what you use for people who consort with demons. And I think demon is what you use for the actual beings.
Yeah, I could definitely stand to be a little bit more clear with my terminology.
Yes and no. One thing is the context clues in the novels. I thought that the context clues were sufficient for me as a, I'd say casual to advanced reader of genre to kind of a, figure out what you're talking about.
Right.
So I never thought that was actually an issue.
Well, you know, before we get away from like the pacing note, yes, I think, you know, this definitely would not stand alone as like a standalone novel. It is certainly, the way that I sort of thought about it, and I don't know if I put this in the end of the book, was like, you know, the pilot of like a TV show or something. Like it's, you know, it's setting up a lot of things and not really knocking it down. The sort of, I don't know, the climax that leads to everything that follows is like the death. And so, yeah, you don't really end this, you know, pilot on like the climax. You end it on like, you know, getting the new team together and, you know, focusing on like their first adventure, which is not like ideal for the pacing of, you know, if it's a TV pilot or if it's a standalone novel. So I could definitely see how that could be frustrating.
I very much got impressions throughout that it was meant for either a visual medium or like a video game. It felt a little, the way that you talk about the suits, the way that you talk about the ironclads with the parts and the models and the makes and the various like flea joints and all of that stuff feels like something I could very easily see like a loadout screen on like a video game of some sort, where it's like, I'm going to put flea joints down here and put a repulsor in a hand. I want this type of sensor. And I'm like, that's cool. That worked.
Yeah.
As a pilot or as a first entry into something sort of longer term, like serialized almost like that. I could see this going all right. I could see this going. It felt at times like there wasn't, and to go back to pacing a little bit, and I guess character motivation right now, there are times where it felt like Tora and the rest of the Jun clan didn't really have anything they meant to do.
Right.
She puts Rosie's eyes out, and then they hang out, and then they wait, and they're like, okay, we're going to keep watch at the secret armory.
Yeah.
And there's not a whole lot of drive beyond that.
Right.
Which I think if you give them something to really aim towards, if you give them something like...
It's interesting because you brought up Lies of Locke Lamora. I mean, in that one, like, they're trying to run, like, a scam, you know, while this thing happens. And so they're a group of, like, con artists, you know, fantasy world con artists. You know, the revenge narrative, you know, comes a little bit later after a lot of their, you know, the things that they're trying to do are spoiled. The fact that Tora, you know, feels the need to, like, incapacitate her old friend, I think that would be made a lot more powerful by her and her group striving towards something on their own. We do justify all the time evil things that we do because it's like, oh, no, I'm going somewhere really good and it'll be worth it.
Yep. And there's a little bit of that. Like Tora and Jun talk a little bit about being mercenaries and being outside of the system, kind of, and how that justifies certain things they do that aren't very nice. But we do, aside from that opening scene... We don't see a whole lot of them actually doing anything.
Right.
We see them communicate with each other and we get some development. So I feel it a little bit when, like, Jun Han gets his leg crushed. I'm like, oh no, he was good at running.
Yeah.
Or he was
like
a, he was a perfect physical specimen and now he's, you know, dead.
Yeah.
As it goes. Or, oh no, he got cooked in his armor. He was like a father to these kids.
And, right. Yeah.
But if, we had seen them pull off a job in between. Like if maybe if Tora's work on Rosie had been more personal just before she had to go meet the rest for a job. And that way maybe she's distracted during the job because of what she's just done to her childhood friend.
Yeah.
Maybe that would give a good amount of weight to what just happened and what follows afterwards when Rosie comes after her.
That's one thing, you know, that a lot of really great writers say is that your, protagonist should be active and not just reactive. Instead of just like defending against the plots of the evil one, there's a goal that your protagonist is like trying to reach. And even if that's like kind of tangential, the fact that they want something and the fact that, you know, they are proactive in trying to get it really allows the audience to be like, oh, this person like has the get up and go and has the and has hopes and dreams of their own.
And it could be a good way to flesh out the other people, Sue, Kim, all the other ones in her group, showing them in action doing their specialized whatever they're supposed to do.
So speaking of that, what did you think of, like, you know, the latter half of the novel is a lot about, or the latter third maybe, is a lot about trying to form a new crew that, you know, is going to head into the depths and, you know, be the people who, you know, are around Tora as she, like, you know, goes for her revenge and whatnot. What did you think of the new crew? And did you, like, get an understanding of, like, why she was able to get them together or, like, what, you know, the whole situation is?
I really liked that part of the novel. I think by that point I had gotten into the groove of it pretty well, and I was like, okay, this is what we're doing, and I like this. I generally like getting the gang back to getting the gang together sequences. I think it's a really fun way to introduce elements of your story, elements of your setting, in a way that feels both internally justified and natural.
Right.
Because you're introducing, like, the soldier. They go to the sparring ring, and it's this woman who, you know, they don't traditionally do too well, but somehow she's managed to, you know, she's tricky, and she's clever, and she's able to do it. Mm-hmm. They get the mechanic, who's this young girl who's trying to squire. Then they need, like, I don't remember what you call it in the novel, but it, like, I would call it, like, the mage. the people who can affect the world in a different way, and they go to the demon nest and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed the actual sequences of getting them together. Mm-hmm. And that's actually one part as I was finishing this up, I was trying to think of how I would have wanted this structured as a standalone, like maybe like 600 page, right, 700 page fantasy, not like a big one, mm-hmm, like a Storm of Swords. That's way too big. Like, right, Game of Thrones, like that, yeah, first one, but, yeah, but self-contained. And I think right now you have a good first act. You have 200 pages right here that works as kind of a setup.
Yeah.
I think I would have taken that last bit where they collect the gang, the new gang, mm-hmm, move that to the second, third, mm-hmm, make that the second act, or at least the first half of the second act.
Right.
Have the first one be the Jun clan putting on a job, have it end with them all getting horrifically brutalized by Eclipse. Mm-hmm. And then you move into Tora getting the new gang together in a little more of an extended fashion. I would have liked more, actually. I would have liked more moments for her to hunt down who the right people are.
Right.
It felt like she secured their allegiances quickly.
Pretty easily, like yes.
It felt natural, mm-hmm, but it did feel very quick.
Right.
And as I watched the percentage bar on my Kindle kind of tick, I was like,
yeah,
okay, that's okay. It's fine. Like, this is a prototype, and I offer this all constructively.
Right.
So I would have liked a lot more of that particular bit, and then maybe have the third act be their descent into the, you know, figurative underbelly, underworld of the machine world, mm-hmm, deal with the shamans and whatever ending you have in mind, right, for this, whatever that may be.
As you're like qualifying these things, this is what's refreshing about this project to me, is like working with critics who, you know, are very eager to approach the text like as it is, and who are willing to be constructive, where like, you know, agents and stuff, it's either yes or no. They don't have time. Like, they just don't have time to like improve your novel or be like, oh, this is what I would do or whatever. It is so fascinating to see what other talented people come up with, because you're right. Like, there's a proactivity that could really benefit from this. I think the only person that Tora like doesn't get to join her crew is dead. And so there's a part, oh, yeah, of that. And there's so much of this that, you know, can be reconfigured, and that's exciting. What's not exciting is to like put your work out and have people like, I liked it, I didn't like it, you know?
So I specifically did not want to approach you with this, because I know you and I have been doing this for long enough,
yeah,
that we've both been in that environment where it's an undergrad 300 level writing course.
Right.
And you put your work out there and you get, you know, it comes to the one person's spot and they're like, you know, I your world's really fleshed out and I really liked it. I don't have anything to say. And it's like, man, just say something. Say you didn't like this line of dialogue. Tell me something.
Yeah.
Give me something to work with.
Yeah.
And I try not to like overcompensate too far in the other direction.
Of course.
But I'm trying to give you plenty of notes, because I think this is very much worth expanding on. I could see this as like a, and I mean this positively, I could see this as like a Bad Robot production.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. I see it with, it feels very sleek. The aesthetic feels very shiny. It feels like it gives itself to a lot of dramatic camera and not maybe not so much lens flare, but you know, a lot of glow, a lot of light.
One of the like fun things about working on this project, trying to have fun with like you said, magic and technology that are sort of indistinguishable from one another. Were there parts of the book where you're like, this technology like goes either too far or not far enough? Does this technology like break something about the narrative?
I didn't have any moments where it felt internally inconsistent.
Okay.
There were no parts where I stopped and was like, that doesn't feel right.
Right.
The thing that struck me as, and I think this might just be a personal taste thing.
Sure.
And this is a relatively small thing, but it definitely took me out when I read it. Giving percentages to the idea of a soul battery. Mm.
Right.
Now, I understand, logically, human propensity. If you have the ability to read a soul's capacity, you would assign it a percentage level so you know how much to expect.
Mm.
But I would offer as a counter the fact that these folks might know how much soul they have because they are draining it, and it's their soul.
Right.
So that in particular, maybe it's just the meshing of percentage with the idea of a soul being your power,
right.
which is
yeah.
very, very concrete to something that is very amorphous and
right.
very kind of like ephemeral. That's the one thing that really struck me as inconsistent.
Yeah.
Only in like a meta
sure.
narrative context.
Yes.
Where I was like, that's the thing that felt a little too video gamey to me.
Sure. Yes.
Because I could very easily see like a heads up display on a computer screen with like soul battery 75%,
yeah.
and then I use my flea joint ability, drops 4%, and I'm like,
right.
you got to get an add on that increases that efficiency by 2.5.
Yeah. Exactly. So one of the fun things that I wanted to play around with this book is the idea of like a first of all, like leveling the physical playing field between people who are different in body makeup. I don't know if that necessarily came across, but like I did want to, give some like female soldier sorts of things that are totally realistic. Like nobody can be like, oh well, men are actually 15% stronger or whatever. It's like, nah. I wanted a
physiological
world where that
differences
was not a,
you know, really should come into play. Yeah,
get politics out of my video games sort of thing. You're right that part of that is I wanted people to have different strengths because of like how strong their like soul is. And that's not just like a lifting weights thing. It's like, you know, being more present and soulful and, you
mm-hmm.
know, emotionally interesting. So, yeah.
Yeah. The real ironclads were the friends we made along the way.
Yes. It all does come back. Every single podcast we've had, it all comes back to friendship. I like that you want it to be consistent with language because that is like, you know, percentage wise, like, you know, we are bringing in an element that doesn't feel true to these people's like artistic souls. And so, yeah, I think that's actually really important. And I would love to think of like a different way to think of that. Because I know, like, for instance, in the book I read of yours, people are, there's the possibility of like, dying and coming back in some really interesting spooky ways, and the language surrounding that and like the way that your characters utilize that part of their world but also like, you know, fear it and, you know, all these different sorts of things,
mm-hmm.
that all felt like extremely consistent, and that was important because, you know, if you're like watching a movie about like the Middle Ages or whatever, and someone's like, go to hell, you piece of crap. And it's like,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't like, I'm out of it now. So, yeah.
I don't know. Maybe something along the lines of just making them feel even more tired, making
right.
them if they don't have part of it feels like if they don't have a battery meter, it makes them feel even more skilled if they have a knowledge of their own limits,
right.
as opposed to having it displayed
yes.
to them.
Yeah.
And I think part of that came from in the prologue when Tora is trying to fight off the ironclad, she spirit binds her body to her soul.
Hmm.
And I almost wanted more of that in a novel where it's just kind of like you bind your spirit to your soul and you become like by becoming not becoming two, but by getting closer to one, you're stronger. I'm like, that's pretty cool. And
yeah.
I think the battery like meter made it feel too externalized.
Right.
When the ironclad and their armor are supposed to be in concert.
Right.
It felt like, I don't know, having a heads up display for what your power level is. It's like if you're trying to run and I guess it's kind of like looking down at your watch and seeing
right.
like,
yeah.
oh, I only have 25 minutes before I have to sit down.
Right, right. That's it's like in a race when you're doing your splits and stuff. Like, oh, I got to be consistent with like the numbers. And
mm-hmm.
yeah, that feels a little cheap. You know, you talked about maybe, you know, not focusing so much on like the travel bits. Did it make like internal sense, you know, why everybody, because a lot of this book is just me trying to justify like people having fist fights and like, you know, not shooting at each other. And so, you know, did that kind of like, did that kind of internal logic make sense? Did you feel like there were any sort of like cheap punches?
So this is kind, this is a difficult question for me because I bought into the premise by the time I started the novel.
Right.
And I never questioned, I never questioned, where are the wrist-mounted rockets? Where's the chest laser?
Yeah.
Where are the micro-seeking darts? I'm like, I think the introduction of the spirit as an actual measurable thing, or at least a very present and knowledgeable thing, introduced an element of fantasy enough where I'm like, they need to fist fight in robot suits.
That's, yeah.
It's an issue that fantasy and genre tend to run into at a certain point where, well, you have all these tools, why don't you do X instead of what you're doing here? And it's like, I just finished reading Dune because it's been on my mind, and the way they justify the fact that everybody just doesn't nuke each other or shoot lasers at each other, they have personal shields and they explode when they're hit by lasers. So that's why everybody sword fights in Dune, and it's great. It's cheesy. And it's
I love it.
Really campy, but I love it. It's great. And I figured, like, I'm trying to phrase this. There's a layer of separation that projectile weapons introduce in a conflict. And I feel like having people in these Magitek-style armored suits justified the lack of projectile weapons. I never once had a moment where I'm like, like I said, I never had a once had a moment where I was wondering why they weren't shooting at each other.
Right.
Partially because I suspected that, I mean, it's really easy to insert a single line where it's like, the invention of the soul mesh plating neglected any attempts at projectile weapons.
Right.
Like, you had to get close and do soul on soul to really affect people, and projectiles can't carry soul or something like that.
Interesting. Yeah.
It introduced, like, make it so that combat with people is personal and really you have to get in close to the people you need to either hurt or dissuade.
Right.
And you have to put yourself at risk in order to do that.
Oh, that's interesting.
Which thematically kind of goes with what you're doing here, at least, because it's all very closely knit people kind of dealing with each other.
So on that note, actually, one concern I had about this novel was like melodrama. There's a lot of like very extreme emotions, weeping and gnashing of teeth and so forth. Did that ever lose you?
There is a big emphasis and repeated talk about the Jisei, the death poems. Which when I first felt introduced to them, I'm like, this is pretty cool. The idea that you have like a short verse at the end of your life with people to remember you by. And then they kept getting brought up. And then it kept being brought up. And I'm like, all right, this society really values their... Tora never struck me... She never struck me as particularly... Like I said, there weren't a whole lot of moments where I never went... I never rolled my eyes at Tora's inner monologue. Just, I guess there were minor times where she felt a little dramatic. But this feels like a dramatic setting. When you exist on a planet which has been very obviously crafted by some hand, there is room for a lot of dramatic fists raised to the sky, talking about things like that. It reminds me, there was a I can't remember what it was called, but the idea was that Earth was a clockwork machine set on a gigantic track around the sun. So everybody on Earth very obviously worshipped the maker, because you had the proof at the equator, and everybody there was very dramatic and very religious. So the fact that they are living on this world that is very obviously artificial, at least in some part, made it feel like they were more justified in raising their voice to someone beyond their presence. And admittedly, genre can be a little melodramatic.
That's
it. Never struck me as it never took away from it, I don't think.
Great.
And I think you would run the risk of making Tora too hard-hearted. I think having her humanity show in how emotional she is about, I mean, she experiences a lot of loss mm-hmm. in a very brutal way in a very short amount of time. Mm-hmm. And I think there are moments where she kind of clamps down on it a little bit. It's like, all right, I got to get this done.
Yeah.
And in other moments where she's cursing everything to right. the, whatever they call it, in the machine layer.
Yeah, to the hellish, the hellfire.
Paradigm? Hell. No, what was it called? Penitence.
So, yeah. There's different, like, levels and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, actually, I was curious what you thought about. So, one thing that I'm trying to do with this novel going forward is sort of, like, class. The idea of, like, people literally being over one another and literally, like, using one another as, like, machine parts.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously this first part of the novel, like, you know, focuses a lot on, like, the higher, you know, classes and stuff. Did that, I'm just curious what you thought about, like, that. Is there anything that, you know, could be done better or worse, you know, with that?
I think this ties back into my desire to see them on a job.
Right.
After the Rosie incident, mm-hmm. because for those first two or three sections of the book, we see them in the rut. We see them on the train with a contractor, and we see them in the smile. It's the rift where
oh,
the
yes.
ones where
yes.
yeah,
yeah,
it's like the gash and
yeah.
And we see that, and we see a few foundries and that sort of thing. But there's not a whole lot of, I don't want to call it day-to-day,
right.
but there's not a whole lot of, like, really feet-on-the-ground moments where they interact with the average citizen of the world machine. There are parts where they interact with working people, briefly, but there's no indication of what day-to-day life for these people is like, outside of these extreme events they're experiencing pretty much from start to finish.
Right.
And I think having some sort of heist go off would give you an excuse to explore that a little bit in the body of the work itself.
Right.
There are definitely mentions of a class structure and striation among society. And I was very curious about that, and I wanted to see more of what the life on the world machine was like.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you should go so far as to have some kid get picked up off the street and be given a window into the world so that you can explain it to us as you explain it to them. I don't think you should go do anything quite that.
Right.
Easy. I think you've got a good framework here to do that. I think you just need to add a segment in there that gives us a real, like, nose in the dirt look at what it looks like for these people to live on this place. Because it's a fascinating world, but we don't see a whole lot of it outside the potential for horrific violence.
Right, yeah. And that's one thing I'm kind of excited about is that, you know, there are these are characters who are coming from, like, a Western-centric, you know, worldview where, like, you know, we in the West are like, oh, yeah, it's, like, it's just a given that I'll have my coffee and my, you know, expensive gaming chair and all these things. And, you know, not really thinking too much about how, you know, our phones are made by slaves and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And so
our chocolate is made by slaves.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the trouble, you know, there is a kind of narrative where you look at, like, the people who are, like, on the bottom of society and then, like, go to see what opulence looks like. And I sort of wanted to start in the opposite direction. Because, yeah, that's how a lot of us Westerners come across these things is, like, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
Being privileged and then slowly coming to realize that the world is a hellscape. All right, this is actually something I've been wanting to ask some people. If you had the powers of the people in this novel, what would you use them for?
Ooh, man, that's a good one. I'm assuming I'm in the world machine and I don't have an ironclad suit in Boulder, Colorado.
Right.
I'd go out into the mountains a whole bunch. I'd fight a mountain lion or something. I don't know. It feels like an everyman in this setting would probably use it to keep and guard their territory.
Mm.
Like, I would probably do it just to make sure, like, the people I love don't get moved on.
Right.
By people who also possess that power. It feels like this is a setting which very much encourages banding together with yours.
Right.
Like, you know who's yours and protect, you know, guard your territory against those who would incur upon it.
Right.
And I don't know that I would be very proactive with it necessarily.
Sure.
Which is why a novel wouldn't be written about me in this world.
Well, that's fine.
Yeah, but no, I'd say, hell, you could probably use it for a whole bunch of utilitarian purposes. I'd probably build stuff a lot more. Mm-hmm. I'd probably be more into crafting, like woodworking or something, because I'd have to guarantee that the saw wouldn't cut a finger off or something.
There you go. Yeah, that's good. That's good.
Yeah.
That's one thing, you know, again, it's like, it's, you know, in a world where magic exists, like, what are the mundane uses, or, you know, what are the, what are, you know, the rest of us who aren't, like, hellbent on revenge doing with their... So
I've found that the presence of magic, or at least non supernatural stuff, I've always found the question of how it would affect the day to day of the every person tends to be a little more interesting than like how it affects the head of the church in his war against whatever. Like what about, you know, how does the ability to conjure, and I'm thinking more classic fantasy, if you can conjure food and water out of the air, why is there any starvation? If you could conjure gold out of the air, what becomes the valuable currency?
Right.
And I think that is, I think that kind of informs society to a certain point in the setting.
Yep. Yep. That's good stuff. Yeah. That's the Brandon Sanderson we were talking about, the, you know,
a little bit.
The new books coming out and just like, oh, what are
Rhythm
the
of war? Yeah.
Yeah. What are the, geopolitical, implications, but also like, how do you, what does grass do?
What's it like to live in a world where a giant storm scours the landscape every 3 months?
And it turns out you get a bunch of crabs. That's
yeah.
Good to have.
Turns out all the plants have tentacles.
good stuff. Hey, Dylan. So you, the reason I was like, oh man, we gotta get podcasting, is that you've got a few shows of yours that you're working on. You want to tell the people about them?
I do. So my name is Dylan. I am part of a creative group out here in Colorado called Some Nobodies. Mm-hmm. You can find everything we do at somenobodies.com. Those projects include Silicon Angels. It is the comedy sci-fi improv series about the tech support company of a specialized robotics manufacturer. And I'm going to keep what they actually manufacture robots in the dark so that you can discover it on your own.
Right.
And because I want to keep Paul's podcast PG. You can find the podcast, a podcast show in which my co-host Zach and I find under-listened to, obscure, and just plain bad podcasts and discuss them very briefly. You can find us every Sunday on YouTube at the IBM TV channel where we do Talking Upstream. It's a 90-minute writer's room where Zach and I, along sometimes with a guest, take two ideas to the board, we choose one, and we develop that into a project we can hopefully work on later.
Cool.
We were developing season twos for all of these, and then the pandemic really stepped up into gear. So we've had to pivot a little bit, but find us all on Some Nobodies, all platforms. We've got some stuff in the cannons. We're about ready to fire. So check us out in the future.
Cool. Cool. Awesome. I can't wait. Dylan, thank you so much for coming on. And I will hopefully have links for everything.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Dude, really appreciate it. And it's a blast from the past, and it's awesome to reconnect. All right. Take care, man.
Oh, yeah.